Have you ever wondered what happened to the legendary Chuck Norris? We recently saw a video he made and it was shocking. He's in his 80s and still kicking butt, working out, staying active, and even has plenty of energy left over for his grandkids. He did this by just making one change. He says he still feels like he's in his 50s. His wife tried too, and she says she feels 10 years younger. Her body looks leaner and she has energy all day. With the stress of everyday life, on top of the toll all the world's terrible news takes on us, it's more important than ever to stay healthy. My Morning Kick is the way to do it. Chuck made a video that explains everything. Make sure you watch it by going to mymorningkick.com/useful. It'll change the way you think about your health. Once again, that's mymorningkick.com/useful. You won't believe how simple it is.
Hi, my name is Peter, and I'm a prophet in the new novel, American Prophet. I prophesied a natural disaster, a pandemic, and that crazy election. Now there are conspiracies about me. A dude is shooting at me, and the president is threatening me. My story is on Amazon, Audible, and Apple Books. Check it out. Just look for American Prophet by Jeff Fulmer. That's American Prophet by Jeff Fulmer.
Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Halper.
I'm Mary Matte. Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. UsefulIdiotsPodcast.com is our website. Go there, support the show, and get bonus content, including your weekly Thursday throwdown, your midweek dose of media madness.
Such a good time. And also extended interviews. What's not to love? Give yourself that gift.
Including this week on the show, we have an extended interview with a Pulitzer Prize winner. I believe this.
Yeah.
This could be a first for Useful Idiots.
Glenn Greenwald won a Pulitzer.
Glenn Greenwald won a Pulitzer.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh my God, we're going to totally alienate whoever else came on the show and won a Pulitzer. And if we're overlooking you, we apologize and we will send you a bunch of roses. Do you remember when Marcos Moulitsas did that? Like he sent hundreds of roses to Nancy Pelosi?
I do remember that. He founded, what's that website? The Daily,
Daily Post.
Yes. We will send hundreds of roses to any Pulitzer winner who we've appeared on, who we've interviewed but have forgotten.
Yes,
that's our promise.
So should we start with the four basic food groups? Democrats suck, Republicans suck. Isn't that weird? Isn't that terrible?
Let's do it. For Democrats suck, let's turn to Joe Biden back when he was running for president. This is what he promised. Trump is fighting tooth and nail to deny those fleeing dangerous situations their right to seek asylum in our nation. We should uphold our moral responsibility and enforce our immigration laws with dignity, not turn away those fleeing violence, war, and poverty.
Amen to that.
Indeed, and he also said this too. We must take urgent action to end Donald Trump's draconian immigration policies. In my first 100 days, we will end his inhumane asylum policies. So that was Joe Biden as candidate.
Another amen moment.
Yes. And what has Joe Biden done as president? Well, he's pretty much forgotten about all of his pledges about treating immigrants humanely, to the point where he's now announced a new policy on immigration. And this is what the ACLU has to say about it. The Biden administration just announced an executive order that will severely restrict people's legal right to seek asylum, putting tens of thousands of lives at risk. This action takes the same approach as the Trump administration's asylum ban. We'll be challenging this order in court. But wait a second. This is the same Joe Biden who promised he was going to treat immigrants humanely, unlike Trump, and that he was going to end Trump's draconian asylum policies.
What happened?
Yeah, well, maybe what happened is he's a Democrat, and Democrats never keep their promises, and they're just the world's biggest hypocrites. And they pander to people who care passionately about an issue that was used to whip up support against Trump and then immediately embrace Trump's own policies. But yet Biden still wants us to think that he's different from Trump, even though he's now embracing Trump's policies. So this is how Biden tried to sell his reversal to the public.
I believe that immigration has always been a lifeblood of America. We're constantly renewed by an infusion of people and new talent. The Statue of Liberty is not some relic of American history. It stands for who we are as the United States. So I will never demonize immigrants. I'll never refer to immigrants as poisoning the blood of a country.
So basically, Joe Biden will not call immigrants names, but he will still deport them and deny them the right to asylum.
Right. This is what we call necessary but insufficient. It's good not to accuse immigrants of poisoning the blood of our society. I'm gonna give Biden credit for not doing that, but it's not enough. That can't be your immigration policy. Your immigration policy can't be Trump but nicer words.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Trump but nicer words. He basically wants us to be impressed that he's not an overt bigot, just a de facto bigot in terms of his policies of denying persecuted people the right to asylum. And again, so many people are fleeing policies that Joe Biden has spent his career imposing, right, namely murderous sanctions on countries that the U.S. government wants to destabilize because it doesn't like their governments. And rather than take responsibility for that and stop the flow of migration by simply lifting sanctions, like stopping the blockade of Cuba, stopping the sanctions of Venezuela and Nicaragua, maybe offering some compensation to countries that were decimated by U.S.-backed dirty wars, Biden is doing the same old thing of demonizing immigrants by denying them asylum and adopting Trump's policies, even while he pretends that he's not Trump because he speaks about immigrants differently.
I mean, I want to say that there is an effect that discourse has. Discourse has an effect on reality. I do think that when you're whipping up hate and xenophobia, that can have real impacts on people's lived daily lives. But that's not enough. You have to provide a policy difference. And what he's doing is tacking right, because he doesn't know how to speak to people about immigration in a way that appeals to people's anxiety and fear and real pain that people are going through. He doesn't know how to speak about it in ways that don't scapegoat undocumented people. Someone who was very good at that, I have to say, is Bernie Sanders, but Biden sucks at it.
Well, and to be fair to Democrats, not all Democrats are behind Biden on this. Here, for example, is Ilhan Omar.
We have a moral obligation to establish a just immigration system that welcomes and protects human beings, a system that upholds our values and offers a lifeline to those who are in desperate need. We cannot allow fear and xenophobia to dictate our policies, which is why I hope that the Biden administration will change course. We must stand up for the voiceless, the vulnerable, the innocent victims caught in this cruel executive order.
So not all Democrats stuck. There's Ilhan Omar remembering that Joe Biden promised to oppose the very draconian asylum policies that he's now embracing. It's pretty clear to me why Biden's doing this. He has a debate coming up with Trump. He doesn't want to be outflanked from the right by Trump on being anti-immigrant because, you know, there is a sizable proportion of the country who've been convinced that this is a major issue and that the way to handle it is by denying people the right to asylum. And again, because nobody in the political spectrum will address the core issue of why are people fleeing. And what can we do to mitigate that? And a major thing we can do is stop creating conditions that force people to flee by trying to destabilize our societies with murderous sanctions. Nobody will touch that because that's a bipartisan policy. When Trump tried to overthrow the government of Venezuela and destroy its economy, as he did with his, you know, sanctions on Venezuela's oil industry, Nancy Pelosi, all the Democrats stood up and gave him a standing ovation at a State of the Union. So because nobody will touch the U.S. policy of sanctions and other forms of coercion, therefore, it's a race to see who can be more draconian towards the people fleeing the damage.
And they know, I mean, they use the buzzword root causes. Kamala Harris, right, who's in charge of this issue, uses the buzzword root causes, but she never actually gets to the root causes. So A plus for effort.
All right, what do we have over in Republican Suck?
So for Republican Suck, the House just voted to pass a bill that would sanction the ICC, the International Criminal Court, over seeking arrest warrants for Israeli leaders. Here is House Speaker Mike Johnson talking about the bill, which he sponsored.
The idea that they would issue an arrest warrant for the Prime Minister of Israel, Defense Minister of Israel, at the time when they're fighting for their nation's very existence against the evil of Hamas as a proxy of Iran, is unconscionable to us. And as I said a couple of weeks ago, the ICC has to be punished for this action. We cannot allow this to stand. If the ICC was allowed to do this and go after the leaders of countries whose actions they disagree with, why would they not come after America? You already have leaders around the world and in smaller countries who take issue with things we do around the globe. Why wouldn't they then issue arrest warrants for the next president of the United States or any of our defense officials? Why not? We have to stand against it. We can't allow bureaucrats to make decisions about what we're doing and come and have this authority. So our legislation, which will have bipartisan support, will apply visa restrictions and economic sanctions to anybody at the ICC trying to investigate, arrest, detain, or prosecute protected persons, including U.S. allies. It's a really important step for us. We know the president doesn't like to listen to us, but I hope that he'll listen to the members of at least his own party who are denouncing the ICC and calling for action. President Biden ought to recognize the danger of letting them pursue these illegitimate investigations and the need to sanction the ICC in response to that.
So there he is saying the quiet part out loud, which is that the U.S. doesn't want to be prosecuted by the ICC either. I mean, to be fair, he's being honest. If the ICC goes after Israel, which they should also be going after the U.S. government. I also do want to give some shouts out to Democrats because 42 Democrats voted for this bill as well. So it's beautifully bipartisan.
Just as they're complaining that Republicans don't respect the rule of law and the sanctity of courts.
Exactly.
Because people were on the Republican side were criticizing the verdict in the Donald Trump trial. These Democrats seem to not care about the sanctity of courts either, except in this case, it happens to come in one of the world's highest courts and in the case of mass murder, which obviously they want to keep enabling. But yes, you know, I've said this before. I hope that as Republicans keep saying it, that, you know, if we allow this prosecution of Israel, then we're next. Lindsey Graham said it. Now Mike Johnson said it. Well, from their mouths to God's ears.
Exactly. To the ICC's ears. And God's, in whichever order makes it more possible. Yeah, agreed. What do we got for Isn't That Weird?
For Isn't That Weird, let's turn to presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. When we last heard from him, he was disclosing that he had been diagnosed with a brainworm many years ago.
He's a brainworm survivor.
He's a brainworm survivor, yep. Now, here he is discussing his appearance on the plane of one Jeffrey Epstein, the presumed late financier, mysterious person who was caught up in all sorts of strange intrigue that kind of remains fully unexplained. And sexual abuse, certainly. That's certainly not a mystery.
Right.
And so like many famous wealthy men, RFK Jr. has been asked to explain why he was on Epstein's plane. And this is what RFK came up with.
Yeah. Oh, and you run into everybody in New York. I mean, I knew Harvey Weinstein. I knew Roger Ailes. I knew O.J. Simpson came to my house. Bill Cosby came to my house.
I mean, Aaron, do you mind if I respond to this as a native New Yorker?
Sure, please. Yeah.
So I did grow up in New York City, and I managed to not run into Harvey Weinstein, Bill Cosby, Epstein, and many other serial rapists. So it's not just New York.
But you must have run into OJ, obviously.
Oh, sorry, OJ. I didn't run into him either.
You didn't run into OJ either? Well, what a coincidence that RFK Jr. happened to run into all these accused and convicted predators and, in one case, an accused murderer. Very strange.
It's
very,
so very funny strange. Because it's actually, I mean, when he first announced, I think he made this disclose that he had been on Epstein's plane on Jesse Waters on Fox News. And, you know, it makes him sound presidential because Trump has been on the Lolita Express. Bill Clinton has been on the Lolita Express. But, you know, there are ways to explain it, kind of.
Yeah.
But this is not the way to explain it. Maybe there aren't ways to explain it. I guess this is one of the worst ways. I'll put it this way. This is one of the worst ways to explain it by saying, no, don't worry. I also hung out with Bill Cosby and Harvey Weinstein. So it's cool. I don't discriminate. I hang out with a lot of sexual predators.
If I was doing PR for celebrities or, you know, famous people like RFK Jr., dealing with Me Too scandals and nefarious associations, the first thing I'd say is, if you're trying to distance yourself from a sexual predator, don't name drop a series of other sexual predators. Right. That's the first thing I'd say.
Yeah. Maybe he was just trying to show he's well-rounded and doesn't discriminate among sexual predators. I mean, he's post-racial or he's colorblind. He hangs out with black sexual predators, white sexual predators, Jewish sexual predators, Goyish sexual predators. There's something beautiful in there.
Well, the campaign season is in full swing now. So that could be a new campaign platform for RFK Jr., sexual predators of all colors and creeds.
Of all colors, yeah, united. So I should disclose, by the way, that I did go to a school that Jeffrey Epstein taught at before my time, which makes the fact that I never ran into him all the more impressive.
Very impressive.
All right. So for Isn't That Terrible, let's turn to Israel. A very heartwarming story about some very interesting people who are protesting in solidarity with Israelis. Let's take a look at I-24, which is an Israeli news channel.
A large display of solidarity seen in the streets of Ashkelon in southern Israel. But take a closer look, and you may be surprised by who's actually waving these blue and white flags.
Basically, my whole family was involved in the Second World War. They were Nazis. They were known as a Nazi family in town.
Hundreds of Germans with their own family history of anti-Semitism.
It's very important for me to be here to say my family story because I'm a descendant of Nazi perpetrators. My family was actively involved in the Holocaust, my grandparents, also my grandmothers. And as I found out, I was very shocked and I want to speak about it because my grandparents, they didn't speak about it.
They're all in the Jewish state participating in March of the Nations, a solidarity mission that brings together Holocaust survivors with descendants of the Nazi regime.
I can't change the past, but it's my responsibility to affect the future and the present times.
I can't change my family's past history of mass murder, but I can now express support for ongoing mass murder.
Exactly. Yeah. I wasn't around to stop the genocide of Jews, but what I can do is support the genocide being perpetuated by Israelis against another group of people.
It's just too on the nose, this one. This one is too on the nose. You know, like those of us who have been making Nazi comparisons, this one
It's humbling.
Humbled that these Nazi descendants would come and validate the analogies that we've been making. But they obviously feel very deeply a deep kinship with ethno-supremacist Israel.
Right. Makes sense. It's just yet another example of Germans making Palestinians pay the price for their crimes.
Yeah. And let's be clear. I mean, you know, in terms of atrocities, nothing can compare to the Nazi Holocaust. Nothing can. And we're not saying that the Gaza genocide is exactly the same, but there are similarities. Gaza is a death camp. The state that is attacking it is an ethno-supremacist state, just like the Nazis were. They're denying people all the basics they need to survive, just as Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto were hit with starvation and other forms of deprivation. So there actually is a lot of similarities there. And I'm not surprised to see Nazi descendants, whether they realize it or not, I think, validating that comparison. Yeah.
So you just can't make that up. And it is definitely, definitely terrible. And yeah, Aaron, like you said, I mean, there are differences. There is kind of a mechanized, industrialized, very methodical killing of Jews. But the point of never again, or at least the way I was raised with it, and obviously you, Aaron, are the son of a Holocaust survivor, but the point of never again was never, never again in this exact way. And anything short of this exact way is a-okay. But that is how a lot of people defend what's happening in Israel. As long as it's not the same thing that happened in Nazi Germany or the same thing that happened in Europe, executed by Nazi Germany, then it's okay. Then we don't have to worry about it. We're in the clear.
You know, like a common argument you'll hear is like, well, if this were genocide, then everybody in Gaza would be killed by Israel, right? So therefore, it's not genocide. Well, is that the standard we want to adopt where everybody has to be dead to call it mass murder or a genocide? Is that what we want to be enabling? Either you oppose mass murder or you don't.
Right.
And either you believe never again when it comes to mass murder or you don't.
And those are your four basic food groups. Hope you're full. Hope you feel satisfied.
For this week's guest, we are joined by Nathan Thrall. He is based in Jerusalem, spent many years as a senior analyst at the International Crisis Group, and is the author of the book, A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, which recently won the Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah, and it's really excellent. A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy, It tells a very moving story about one father searching for his son after a bus accident. And it's so good that I started reading it on Kindle, and I was so engrossed by it that I also bought the audiobook so I could listen to it while I was in transit, and because I couldn't wait to get back home to read it. So highly recommend it.
All right, let's go to Nathan's Raw. Nathan Thrall, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start by asking you for your analysis of the confusion over the ceasefire on the table. Joe Biden gives a speech recently saying that the onus is on Hamas to accept Israel's ceasefire proposal. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu then says that our goals have not changed. We'll not accept an end to this war until Hamas is completely destroyed. Yet some other Israeli officials say they have accepted the ceasefire. What is your take? What is the ceasefire offer on the table, and who are the main obstacles?
So the offer, by all accounts, is in Biden's speech, is basically the Israeli offer that was presented privately, and that Biden was then publicizing this offer in order to corner Netanyahu and force him to actually accept publicly what his negotiators had put forward. Now, one of the reasons that he felt that he needed to do that is because the offer looks like a total defeat for Netanyahu's voters and for much of the Israeli public, because it entails all three phases of this deal would entail essentially leaving Hamas in place and a full withdrawal from Gaza and a major prisoner exchange and a full end to the war. Netanyahu has messaged over and over again throughout the war, and especially in recent months, that he will not end this war. Israel absolutely, categorically refuses to end the war until Hamas is totally defeated. And this is a total contradiction of that. And so since Biden has put that proposal out, he has been quite cagey, and he has repeated that, you know, our position hasn't changed. We still demand the defeat of Hamas before we're talking about an end to the war, which is in direct contradiction of the proposal as put forward by Biden. But he claims in his messaging, he's trying to make it sound as though there's no contradiction.
So where do you think this is heading? Is there any political space inside Israel right now for Netanyahu to accept either a permanent ceasefire or at least a temporary one, which is what the first stage of this proposed deal is supposed to be for 6 weeks?
Yeah. So that's the giant loophole in this deal, is that it consists of three phases, and the permanent ceasefire comes in the second phase. During the first phase, which is a limited prisoner exchange, they're supposed to negotiate the second phase, which is a broader prisoner exchange and the permanent ceasefire. And so Hamas has very little reason to believe that Israel would go into this and actually see it through to the end of the three phases. And that's one of the great difficulties in this deal for the Biden administration. I do think that Netanyahu would like to see just the first phase implemented. So then he gets a limited prisoner exchange, and he gets to resume bombing Gaza at the end of that, just like we had in the fall.
What is the atmosphere like in Jerusalem, where you're based right now? What do people want from this government at this point? And can you describe the tension between the hostage families and the rest of Israeli society?
You know, there is widespread support for the hostage families, and the hostage families, the majority of them, are blaming this government for not doing nearly enough to bring home the hostages. Many of the kind of center-left voters who came out in large numbers to protest against this government before October 7th over the so-called judicial reforms that were being put forward, those same people are out now protesting against this government. The messaging behind those protests is not entirely clear. They are calling for a return of the hostages. They're calling for elections. They're demanding that the government do more. But if you were to try and discern what exactly, how they think a return of the hostages is going to happen, are they actually demanding an end to the war now without Hamas being defeated? That's not clear at all. And so there are separate protests, which are very tiny, which are about the dead in Gaza and end the war. And that's an entirely different phenomenon.
What do you think the government's goals are right now? There's obviously talk of a political motivation for Netanyahu, which Biden, kind of shockingly, but also kind of predictably, because he's so gaffe prone and has these moments of honesty by accident, he referred to Netanyahu's, that it's reasonable to believe that Netanyahu is extending the war for political reasons. How much is it political survival for Netanyahu? How much is it the desire to ethnically cleanse Gaza? Is it both of those things?
Well, obviously, Netanyahu has his political survival as a key interest and one of the major reasons why the proposal that Biden put forward is so difficult for him is that his coalition falls apart immediately if he agrees to it. And so that is, you know, number one for Netanyahu. But of course, he does indeed want to continue to pulverize Gaza. And I think that, you know, many on the Israeli right believe that actually the war is not going as badly as many detractors might say. And this is all much more sustainable than people realize. There was a, you know, presentation by Netanyahu's former national security advisor, Yaakov Amidror, who gave a kind of very rosy picture of the war and talked about how we still have U.S. support. Don't listen to all the noise. That's there 100%. That's what matters. We, you know, took a long time to take over Shifa Hospital the first time, but when we went back the second, you know, it's a half hour and we were in there, and the rest of Gaza is going to be like that too. We can establish a number of corridors, like they have one corridor splitting North and South Gaza. We can establish a number of those, and then Gaza is fragmented into little pockets like the West Bank, and we can go and do raids as needed. Until we just exhaust them. This is what we did in the Second Intifada. We had Operation Defensive Shield. We went into the city centers in the West Bank. And then as needed, we go back and we raid and we invade and we exhaust them. We can do this. So I think that's a view that's not that far from reality if the external pressure remains as weak as it is.
And let me ask you your thoughts on what Hamas is thinking. I know that Hamas is not a monolith. There's a split between the armed wing that's actually inside Gaza and the political wing, which is based outside of it. But let's start with October 7th and move to the present. Do you have any sense of what Hamas was thinking in terms of its goals for October 7th? Was the way it was executed, did it go according to plan? Were the atrocities that happened against Israeli civilians, was that a part of a plan? I mean, you've covered the Middle East for a very long time as a senior analyst at the International Crisis Group. I'm curious, like, your thoughts on whether what happened on October 7th, how that jibed with your understanding of Hamas and their strategy. And to the extent you can speculate, you know, what their thinking was in launching that operation, I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Sure. You know, I think speculate is the right word, because even within the leadership of Hamas, I think there were many who had no idea that this was coming. So my own view was, like many others, I believed that Hamas thought the number one priority now was the West Bank, and that their real effort was to try and have some kind of uprising take place in the West Bank. And I had heard that from them over many, many years, interviews in Gaza. And so, you know, this was a total shock to every kind of analyst of this place, including analysts close to Hamas, including analysts close to, you know, Israel. Everybody was shocked by what happened. And, you know, I think that the primary goal was to turn over the table. They had tried everything. They had tried this march of return. The whole world watched as unarmed Gazans were slaughtered by Israeli snipers on the border as these people are just protesting toward the Gaza border fence. They had tried multiple wars with Israel, and they had tried, you know, keeping the peace and hoping that the siege was going to be eased. None of these things were working. It seemed to them that they were trapped in a situation of perpetual siege and a population that, despite knowing that Israel is the one imposing the siege, nevertheless does attribute some blame to their own rulers for the situation. So I think that the main overriding objective was to try and overturn the status quo with the most dramatic act that they could possibly do. And it remains to be seen how successful they will be. I mean, it's not impossible that they will succeed in getting a new kind of arrangement. It's also possible that, for example, if this Biden plan were to go through, that we would see more or less a return to what we had before. Hamas rule in Gaza, Gaza under siege, and we're, you know, this will be remembered as this terribly bloody war, but actually, in terms of its consequences, not having changed that much, just like the previous so-called rounds had not changed much.
And again, I understand this is just more speculation, but to the extent you can answer, where do you think Hamas sees itself now in terms of its strategic position? I mean, yes, the Palestinian issue is now on the world stage like it never has been, but also, you know, Gaza's been almost completely destroyed. Tens of thousands of people have been killed. There are reports in U.S. media that U.S. intelligence believes that Israel's only killed a relatively small amount of Hamas fighters. So Hamas militarily appears to be holding strong. But where do you think Hamas sees itself now in terms of its strategic position, in terms of advancing its long-term goals? And do you think they want to hold on to power inside Gaza whenever this ends?
So one thing I will say is that the way that Hamas has performed militarily over the last 8 months has shocked everyone almost as much as the initial attack. To think that the, you know, regional superpower, Israel, needed to be rearmed within weeks of this thing starting, and Hamas is under a total siege, an even tighter one during this war, deprived of food, water, fuel, electricity, and they are still fighting 8 months on, and areas that Israel declared that they had vanquished, they are still losing soldiers in those places. That I think everybody is utterly shocked at their ability to keep going in this way. And, you know, I think that they politically feel that they are in the strongest position they've ever been in. They are at the center of the Palestinian issue. They have brought the Palestinian issue to the top of the international agenda. We have European states have now recognized the state of Palestine in the middle of this bloodshed, and that would not have happened if it weren't for October 7th and this war. And they are very popular now among Palestinians, and they are in a position to lead the Palestinians. I think that things have gone very, very well for them so far, despite the terrible price for Palestinian civilians in Gaza.
You're joining us from Jerusalem, where you live. What brought you to Jerusalem, and what is life like there for Palestinians?
So I was working as an editorial assistant at the New York Review of Books, and I did a reported piece from the West Bank. I was visiting with my then partner, and I did a reported piece on the U.S. training of Palestinian security forces and the project of so-called state building that was taking place in the West Bank. The idea, which went under the name Fayyadism after the Prime Minister at the time, Salam Fayyad, was that you would build a Palestinian state from the ground up by You know, having the Palestinians check all the boxes and show that they are ready for statehood and have the World Bank and the IMF say that the Palestinians have done everything. They've provided Israel with security. They've reformed their security forces. We're not focused on this so-called top-down process of peacemaking, which is a failure and hasn't gone anywhere. And Fayyad is the new David Ben-Gurion, and he understands what the Zionists understood, which is that you just have to build the state on your own from the ground up. And I came and I reported on that, and it was a very critical piece at a time when all of Washington and Europe was enthralled with this idea. And basically, you know, shortly after that piece was published, the head of the Middle East program of the International Crisis Group, Rob Malley, reached out to me, said he really liked the piece, said that his organization had been working on something similar and was soon to publish it. And would I like to basically do the same kind of thing for the International Crisis Group, the same kind of writing, but with a lot more footnotes? And I said I was interested. He said, where in the Middle East would you like to go? And I said, Gaza. And within weeks of this article being published, I was in Gaza, living there and writing my first report for the International Crisis Group. So that's how I came here. They liked what I wrote. And then I moved to Jerusalem permanently after that. You know, the life for Palestinians in Jerusalem is highly, highly segregated. This is one of the most divided cities in the world. You have, you know, separate bus lines for Palestinians. You have Palestinian neighborhoods that Jews basically do not enter. You have Palestinian neighborhoods that are walled off from the rest of the city, although officially part of the city, where Palestinians are paying municipal taxes and receiving virtually no services. And we're talking about not a small number of Palestinians, about a third of the population or more in Jerusalem that's living in these circumstances of having to go through a checkpoint every morning within the city. This is not a checkpoint separating the West Bank from Israel. This is a checkpoint within the middle of the occupied territories, within the middle of annexed East Jerusalem, from one part of the city to another, that Palestinians have to cross through to go to their schools and their jobs. And life for these Palestinians is miserable. They are living under a policy of deliberate neglect. People in these communities on the other side of the wall have no sidewalks or playgrounds or really any basic services. They're burning trash in the middle of the street. The infrastructure is, for a much smaller population. So you have, for example, in the area of Shuafat camp, you have the major thoroughfare for about 130,000 people in a walled enclave. It's just one narrow road that's too narrow in some places for a bus and a car to pass each other. And so people are, spending hours just moving within this enclave or trying to get out of it to go to their jobs. And that's the policy in Jerusalem, a very deliberate policy of, a shortage of thousands of classrooms, schools operating in double shifts for Palestinians. And what it leads to is many Palestinians wanting to move elsewhere, to move to the West Bank, to move to Ramallah, to some place where they feel like they can breathe a little bit more. The problem with that doing that is that if you do that, Israel will revoke your Blue Jerusalem ID card, which allows you to enter the city. And so if you grew up, let's say, near the old city of Jerusalem, and you decided to move to Ramallah, Israel can strip you of your Jerusalem residency and you'll never be able to go to your family home and visit your relatives near the old city.
Just as a side note, I want to mention, Nathan, that you talked about being hired by Robert Malley at the International Crisis Group. Well, for audience, it's important to know that he actually is a current Biden administration official, but he's been sidelined in a very odd classified documents case from his role as a special envoy for negotiations with Iran. And it's worth noting that Robert Malley is despised by a lot of people, right-wing, hawkish people in Washington, neocons, because of his role, for example, in negotiating the Iran nuclear deal, which Trump tore up and Biden refused to go back to. And also because he told the truth about the so-called peace process when he noted that, contrary to what we heard in the US media, the Palestinians never turned down a so-called generous offer from Israel back in 2000 during the peace process negotiations and at Camp David and afterwards at Taba. And Robert Malley was there actually working as a US negotiator. So it's just interesting that the one person said the Biden administration who's done work to advance peace, he's been sidelined from his job, and he's still, and this has been going on for months now. I don't know if you have any comment on that, if you're
no, I know very little about that, but Rob is a dear friend, and we're all lucky that somebody as smart and talented as him has decided to work for the U.S. government for all these years.
And maybe the U.S. government will let him work for them because they've sidelined him. Well, Nathan, let's talk about your Pulitzer-winning book, A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy. For those who are not familiar with the story, tell us about it and how you came to work on it.
So the book tells the story of a tragic bus accident that took place on the outskirts of Jerusalem. I had just mentioned a particular community that's a walled enclave. The parents and the children involved in this bus accident lived in a walled enclave. The town is called the Shuafat Camp and Anata. About 130,000 people surrounded by a 26-foot-tall gray concrete wall. A fourth wall blocks them off on the other side that runs through a segregated road known as the Apartheid Road, with Israeli traffic on one side and Palestinian traffic on the other. The students at this school, the kindergartners, came from families who both had blue Jerusalem IDs that let them go through the checkpoint to enter the rest of the city, and also families that didn't, that had green West Bank IDs and couldn't enter the rest of the city. So rather than going to a playground or a play area just on the other side of the wall, they went a very long and circuitous route that all of the kids on the bus could go to the outskirts of Ramallah. And on their way there, they were struck by a giant semi-trailer that was on its way to a settlement quarry, was extracting resources from the West Bank, and bringing them to a factory in the settlement industrial zone of Atarot in East Jerusalem. And the semi-trailer struck this bus. It flipped over, burned. And because this occurred on a road that is used almost entirely by Palestinians, it's in Area C of the West Bank, which means it's in an area that's under complete Israeli not just security control, but administrative control. Israeli police give out traffic tickets on this road. But because it's a road that's used mostly by Palestinians, and because there is this utter neglect of the very large Palestinian population on the other side of the wall, it was more than a half an hour before the first Israeli fire truck arrived on the scene. And in the book, I tell the story of the crash, of the children, of the parents. The title comes from one of the parents, Abed Salama, who had a son on the bus and who was trying to just find out what happened to his son, where his son was. Abed does not have a blue ID. He cannot enter Jerusalem. He arrives at the crash and is told that his son could be at one Jerusalem hospital, at another Jerusalem hospital, at the military base, just a minute up the road at the Ramallah hospital. And he cannot access any of those places except the Ramallah hospital, which is where he goes. He calls on relatives who do have the right color ID to go search for his son at Jerusalem hospitals. And through his story and the story of other parents and also Israeli first responders, the founder of the Israeli settlement right next to where the accident took place, the architect of the wall, which Israelis refer to as the separation barrier, through all of these characters who live these very segregated lives, very close to one another, but totally separate from one another, but whose lives do come into violent collision on this day, I try to tell the bigger story of Israel-Palestine through their eyes and their family histories.
One of the characters in the book, which I highly recommend, it's an amazing read. It's very disturbing, obviously, but also there are parts of it where you're just immersed in people's lives and you get a sense of real characters as opposed to just victims. And one of the characters who shows up to help rescue people, Salem, is actually attacked by Israelis for criticizing the slowness with which they arrive at the scene, which I found maybe naively shocking that on top of this tragedy, they then punished someone who tried to help rescue people. Can you talk about that part of the book?
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiotspodcast.com.
Well, thank you so much to Nathan Thrall for joining us. I always learn a lot when I hear him speak on this topic. He's very, very knowledgeable about Israel-Palestine, you know, being based there and having worked so many years at the International Crisis Group, covering it as an analyst. And his book, we cannot recommend enough. There's a reason why even the Pulitzer Prize, which, you know, often makes terrible decisions, had to go out of its way to acknowledge this book because it's just so powerful and really captured the essence of the Israeli occupation of Palestine. And so a very well-deserved award for Nathan Thrall. We're very lucky that he could join us.
And also for our subscribers, and if you don't already subscribe, you're going to want to at usefulidiotspodcast.com. The extended interview with Nathan is fascinating. He talks about the future of a one-state solution or a two-state solution, why he actually doesn't want to talk about that, and also talks about being Jewish while being in Gaza.
Spoiler alert, contrary to what you might hear from Israel supporters about being Jewish in Gaza, Nathan Thrall left unharmed and actually was treated very, very well.
Yeah,
much better than he'd ever be treated if he went to, for example, to a West Bank settlement.
Right, by the settlers, correct,
and by his fellow Jews.
Right. All right, guys, thank you so much, and we will see you next week.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. If you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at Useful Idiot Pod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.